With the push to improve standards in math, science, and literacy education, social studies is, in some ways, the subject left behind. Today, we'll talk about teaching social studies in Iowa schools. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. History, government, current events, these aren't subjects that prepare students to do well on standardized tests. But many would argue that they are subjects that prepare students to be good citizens. This hour, we'll talk about how social studies is taught in Iowa schools. I'll also talk with exceptional social studies teachers, and then we'll focus on innovative programs designed to help educators bring history to life. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. The core curriculum is designed to make it easier to track the progress of students as they learn, with a particular emphasis on math and literacy. Social studies is still taught in schools, but it's harder to test and harder to track. And as schools scramble to boost test scores and meet benchmarks, some fear that history, government, and current events are falling by the wayside. This hour, we'll talk about how social studies is taught in Iowa schools. I'll also talk with some exceptional social studies teachers. And we'll focus on innovative programs designed to help educators bring history to life for their students. We also want to hear from you this hour. You can send us an email about a social studies teacher or an educational experience that really made a difference to you. You can post on our Facebook page, you can tweet us at IPR Talk, or you can send that email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And my first guest today is Circe Stumbo. She is president of West Wind Education Policy in Iowa City. Hello, Circe.
Hello. Glad to be here.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here today. And I'm going to ask you some general questions about how social studies is taught in Iowa. I understand that Iowa is just one of the states that you work with as a policy advisor on education. You don't represent the state of Iowa.
That's correct, yes. We work with state departments of education across the country. We do have some work with Iowa, not directly with the Iowa Corps, but it's related as it sets the foundation for pretty much everything in the state of Iowa.
All right. Well, I know that social studies is a part of the Iowa Corps. Can you give me a rough idea of how it fits in with the other subjects?
Sure. So the Iowa Corps standards are statements of what we generally in Iowa expect students to know and be able to do. Iowa has a philosophy of local control. As much as possible, decisions about education are left up to local school districts, schools, and teachers. But there are some common expectations that we hold in the state. And so we do have standards in several of the subject areas, including social studies. And within social studies is where you then find history standards. The statements in the Iowa Corps are pretty broad, pretty big ideas, concepts. They don't get into things like specific dates that students should know. They don't get into how teachers should teach students to learn and achieve those concepts, understand and develop those skills.
And they do have a sort of a broad definition of the different areas that schools should be covering, including behavioral sciences, economics, geography, history, political science, and civic literacy. So that's kind of where all of these different subjects fall under the umbrella. But it doesn't tell a student that you must have these courses.
That's correct. Yep. And generally, they are in grade spans. So it's over the course of your primary grades, the K-2, 3, 5, I believe, 6, 8. What are the kinds of concepts and skills students should achieve? So again, much of the decisions about when and how the specifics take place is left up to locals.
All right. But each of those subjects could be a class itself.
Absolutely.
Or worked into the curriculum in some other way. So these are pretty broad guidelines.
They are very broad. I also would like to note that nationally, the Common Core state standards had a lot of attention. These are over 40 states have agreed to some common standards in English language arts and in mathematics. Now, how you, again, attain the knowledge and skills within those subject areas can happen across the curriculum. So reading across the curriculum is actually quite important to the English language arts standards. So much of a student's capacity in reading and in writing will happen in a social studies class.
Well, and looking through the recommendations for schools, that was something that kind of surprised me. Here's a statement from the Iowa Core. In social studies, students develop knowledge, skills, and dispositions, including, but not limited to, possessing basic knowledge and ways of thinking drawn from many academic disciplines. That's pretty broad. But expressing ideas in written form, reading reflectively and critically, analyzing their own and others' opinions on social issues, and becoming motivated to participate in civic and community life. So a lot of that emphasis actually seems to be on literacy.
Yes, I would say that as a nation, we've agreed that fundamentally our schools need to help our students learn to read, write, and do computations.
All right. So even though your child may be in a social studies class, really in many ways, depending on the class, their ability to write an essay may be a more important measure of how they're succeeding in that class as opposed to what they're learning about government?
I wouldn't go so that far, quite that far, because we do have standards in Iowa in the social studies area. And so there are specific concepts within social studies that we do want our youth to be learning. But again, how we get there and the details of what that means are really a local decision. So, for example, the Iowa City Community School District would typically have a curriculum director who would work with the teachers to design the curriculum over the grade spans in order to think about the specifics of what we want the students to be doing.
All right. I want to bring Dominic Iannone into the conversation. He is a social studies teacher at West High in Iowa City and also teaches summer courses with the Bell and Blank Center in Iowa City. Hello, Dominic.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
And since we were just talking about a focus on literacy, you actually have run into that in the past as a social studies teacher, being told in a middle school class that your focus should be on literacy.
Yeah, that's true. I think that it's something that's happening across the social studies curriculum. We have a national organization, the NCSS, National Council on Social Studies, that has a conference every year. And a lot of their sessions recently have been on incorporating literacy into social studies curriculum. And I think a lot of it is obviously, as social studies teachers, we're pro-literacy.
Yes. But I think almost all teachers are.
Right, yeah. I think that's important. But also, I think a lot of it has to do with finding ways to keep our curriculum relevant because, you know, we know that there's a lot of standardized testing, but social studies is generally not tested. And so I think that there's some trepidation about losing minutes to other types of curriculum if we're not kind of covering some of those tested bases. Right. And at the junior high level in Des Moines, I certainly encountered that, but it's something that I think is nationwide.
So I don't know if you're comfortable talking about this, but as a social studies teacher, how did you feel when you were told that?
I want to go on the record as pro-literacy. I believe in reading. And I think that there are lots of good ways to incorporate literacy into the social studies curriculum. We obviously do a lot of reading, and a lot of the things that we read are challenging primary sources and historical documents. It can be a challenge to find ways to balance the traditional content of social studies classes with some of those newer demands. But it's also something that is not going away. And so as social studies teachers, we've kind of recognized that we need to be at the forefront of this rather than kind of trailing the wagon and finding out later what it is that we're going to be doing.
If I could just jump in, again, nationally, we've got the Common Core State Standards, which Iowa has signed on to. And one of the big changes in English language arts is a stronger emphasis on nonfiction. So not simply focusing on fiction and personal essays, that sort of thing, but really nonfiction. That happens in a social studies classroom. So it is literacy is part of social studies, being able to read nonfiction and make sense of it and analyze data, these kinds of things. Mathematical literacy also. When you get into statistics, where does statistics come to life? Largely in a social studies classroom.
Now, with the different states that you work with, Searcy, and I'm not sure if this is something that you would have a handle on, but obviously a lot of school districts have a lot of money problems. I mean, we see that everywhere where different things get cut. Often it's arts that get cut first. Do we see social studies teachers getting cut when times get tough?
That's a tough question, and it's hard to we don't have a lot of data to back that up, although I would say for the most part, no. I think social studies is pretty well accepted. The challenge is the amount of time given to the subject. In the in the schools that really know how to raise student achievement as measured by standardized test scores, they recognize that students learn those things that may be tested in all of the courses that are offered. So to the extent that the reading teachers can support the social studies teachers because it's in the social studies classroom that the content comes alive, that's where you see the higher test scores.
Now, you mentioned earlier that there is a lot of local control. Mm-hmm. A lot of local decisions are made in school districts about how things are taught, what courses are offered. I can imagine, Dominic, that creates some exciting opportunities for teachers to have the opportunity to develop their own coursework.
Yeah, absolutely. There is a lot of autonomy for social studies teachers in the state of Iowa. And in some ways, it is great because those standards are so broad that there's lots of different ways to teach it. The challenge that we have is trying to find ways within that autonomy to make sure that students in different classrooms, even within the same building or the same district, are getting comparable learning experiences, which is not to say that all teachers have to teach the same curriculum in the same ways, but that we're trying to tie it back to those big concepts and that students come out with similar big understandings.
I can imagine that there a math class from district to district would have a lot more similarities than any kind of social studies class from district to district.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true.
So I can see some pitfalls in that too as well, Circe. I mean, I can see the exciting opportunities for freedom and for innovation, but I can also see possible opportunities for neglect within a district.
That is a challenge, and that's one of the reasons that the standards movement sort of came about, was to say at some point we have some common expectation that we're going to hold schools accountable to. And so there is an intent to say these standards aren't just there to guide you. They really are expectations for what you're going to help your students to achieve.
All right. So would you say that there's a movement to create more consistency?
There is, indeed, and there's also pushback against it. Any time we move one direction, we then push back the other way. And it's a constant sort of balance between local autonomy and local capacity. Many of the teachers in Iowa for a long time who did not have state standards saw what other states were doing, which was in essence providing more resource back to the teacher. The more common the curriculum, the more resources are available. And so there's this tough kind of back and forth between I want to have my ability as an individual teacher to make my own classroom choices, and yet I don't want to make every single choice alone. I really do need some support. So what the state of Iowa did is develop some model curricula to say, I'm not expecting or requiring you to do this, but here's some models that you can use to support your teaching.
We're talking about teaching social studies in Iowa. With me is Circe Stumbo. She is president of Westwind Education Policy in Iowa City. Also with me, Dominic Iannone, who is a social studies teacher at West High in Iowa City. We're going to talk to another exceptional social studies teacher here in just a moment. We also want to hear from you this hour. Tell us about your exceptional social studies teachers. Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about teaching history in Iowa. And in preparation for the show, we asked people to tell us about a teacher who really made history or cultural events come alive for them. And a name that came up several times is Tom Detterman, who taught at Hempstead High School in Dubuque for many years. He's also the founder of the Global Perspectives Leadership Award, a scholarship for high school seniors. One of his former students, Sherry Donath Porter, wrote this about her former teacher and his global issues class. Thomas Detterman's class was life-changing for me in all the best ways. Before walking into that class, I was just a working-class Iowa girl from a working-class Iowa family who thought she might one day teach at a preschool or something. I didn't think I was smart. I didn't aspire to anything. My world was what I saw around me in Dubuque, and that world was neither hopeful nor inclusive. It certainly wasn't global. And then came my first assignment in your class. Each student was orally given a unique research task. All you said to me was, Steve Biko, research and report back to the class. This task was over my head in so many ways. I lacked the skills and the general knowledge I needed to even attack the problem. I didn't know about apartheid. I didn't know about the Reader's Guide to Periodical Literature. I had not yet been to the school library. You directed me to the library and to the Reader's Guide, and I managed on my own from there. That day alone might have been enough to change the course of my future. But fortunately, I had many more of those days with you. I got to know you better through various clubs. I felt proud every time you asked me what I thought about something, as if what I had to think and say about a subject mattered. And that's just an excerpt from an open letter from a former student, Sherry Donath Porter, to Tom Detterman. And Tom Detterman is on the phone with me now. Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Well, you're welcome, Charity.
Now, I know that you were inspired by all of the things that you saw going on around you in the 1960s, the civil rights movement, the women's movement, protests against the war. Why did you decide, with that inspiration, why did you decide to become a teacher?
Well, I think two reasons. Two teachers, actually. One was a role model teacher who lived across the street from me, who I saw coming home every day with a briefcase and wearing his professional clothes. And I followed what he did, admired what he did, and thought, I want to do that too. And then I had, unfortunately, a mediocre teacher in ninth grade who consigned us to do a lot of meaningless stuff, if you would, in history. And so one day we went and asked him if we could teach the next day's lesson while he stayed in the back. And I think he read the newspaper that day. And we did. And I got up there, and the adrenaline simply surged in my body, knowing that I was able to impart something of value to my own peers. And those two experiences led me by eighth grade to know that I wanted to be a teacher.
What did you teach in that first lesson?
We taught American history. We taught about the beginning or the days just before the outbreak of the Civil War. And so I researched that, studied it. We made some questions, and we got the kids involved in a discussion of it, which I think surprised the teacher.
So you've seen mediocre teachers, you've seen great teachers. When you became a teacher yourself, did you have a role model, or did you try to set out to create something new, some new way to reach the students in your class?
Well, I would tell you this, Charity. My first year, I was so frustrated because of my lack of ability, at least in my own mind, I considered changing jobs because I didn't think I was making a difference with a lot of kids. And I came to realize very quickly my own training, even though it was good training, didn't go far enough in getting me to a place where I knew what would connect with kids. In other words, I knew the content well. I don't think I knew the strategic decisions well. And so to work and try to figure out how to be a different kind of teacher. And a moment in my life that really made a difference was the fact that in my second year, I did say, my second year of teaching, I found a notice in the Iowa Council of Social Studies newsletter. There was a workshop in Muscatine, Iowa, and it was on global education. I didn't know global education anything out at that point. Never heard the concept before. Should have, but didn't. And so I went to this workshop in Muscatine, in the basement of a Presbyterian church, with a woman named Jan Grum, who worked for the Stanley Foundation. And I came out of that weekend with my head completely spinning. I came out of that weekend as a different person. I came out of it a different teacher, all because I learned how much I didn't know. And so I went back to school, and thankfully, people who trusted me and said, I have to do something with what I learned. And it has to do with this global education concept. Can I teach? If I design it, you let me teach a global education course for at least a semester. Let's see how it goes. And they did. And at that point, I was really surprised. So for about a semester, I spent a lot of hours trying to put together a first iteration of what we're going to call global issues. It didn't exist until that point, what we called just history. And this was not history, at least not packaged the same way. So I taught the course. It was all done with themes, and I was able to corral, recruit enough students, freshmen through seniors, to get that semester under my belt. And from there, we just did better and better.
Do you remember a lesson that you came up with for your global issues class, maybe one of the first times that you really felt like you were connecting with the students and really igniting their interest and broadening their worlds?
In fact, I tried something in my world history class. It had gone so well that I tried to apply the concept. The concept was this. I really came to believe more learning takes place when there's more emotion. And to have emotion, students have to get outside of themselves. And so what we did in world history one semester was we set up the United Nations, and we were in 1945. We were trying to establish UN. So my kids became members, actually diplomats for various countries in the UN. It wasn't a long-term thing, but I could see the lights coming on in their eyes because they got to be somebody. And so what we did in my class was, first week you came in, you were one of my students. I would say, Charity, I want you to pick three countries that you'd like to represent and bring them in the week. I'll pick the one you get. And then from now on, when you're in class, we're in our simulation mode, you're not Charity. You are, for example, the People's Republic of China. I don't want to hear about what Charity thinks. I want to hear what People's Republic of China thinks about this issue. And kids really bought into that. Within 6 weeks, they knew a lot about their countries, and they would even take offense if someone criticized their country. So I knew I was making an inroad toward getting them outside of themselves and getting at their emotions.
In the last few weeks, in the last few months, you've had a tremendous outpouring of support from your community in Dubuque and from your former students. And that's because you're very, very ill. But it's also because you are incredibly loved by your students and by your community. What has it meant to you to hear from so many former students telling you that you did change their lives?
Well, first, it's very humbling to know that I've had any quantum of influence on students who, you know, I saw basically either for 1 year, but some of the students I saw for 4 years, too. That was really a good experience. I guess it's part of the legacy that every teacher hopes that you leave behind. Students who are curious, students who feel like may have had some influence in the direction that their life took in the process, and that they truly are engaged citizens. We're way short on engaged citizens, and that's where I think social studies and history have to pick up the pace. Got to read civics, too. We've got to be engaged with people, because our democracy will simply not function. We don't have engaged citizens. Without that, without a sense of context of our experience, our history, if you would, we only think today is important. I don't know how we can make informed decisions about how to shape our future. And then high school, middle school, even grade school. We're teaching history here in Dubuque for about grades 4 through 11. So we're trying to do our best job, making sure that they get both job skills. These kids aren't going to be historians. They need to be citizens. And to be a good citizen, you simply have to have context. And that's where I think where good history teaching comes into play.
You have created the Global Perspectives Leadership Award to award a scholarship to high school seniors who want to use their global knowledge and be global leaders to do something to make the world a better place. Is this your legacy?
Well, I think that and the endowment under which that is a umbrella. We're also committed, we're starting in September, to we're going to have a teacher institute, much like the one I went to back in 1972, in Muscatine, a teacher institute for 6 tri-state school districts we've chosen this first year. We're going to get some key leaders in all those districts to a 2-day workshop institute. Then we're going into schools with people to help our people and their people. Teach every teacher, they have to be a global educator. Doesn't matter what you teach, but especially in social studies, you have to be a global educator. And that makes the job more difficult because we've got more content and less time.
Tom Detterman, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Tom Detterman was a teacher at Dubuque Hempstead High for many years. And we have heard from a number of people who want to nominate their favorite history or social studies teacher. Jeff says, Kirk Dadow, Ames Senior High, perhaps the country's only Marxist high school football coach. Our unit on socialism began with him doing a striptease to reveal his favorite Che t-shirt to a 45 RPM of the Internationale. We also heard from Mark, who said that Bill Lemkuhl in Fort Dodge was a great storyteller that enthralled his students with facts in a creative way. A second mention of Mr. Lemkuhl. This is from Jeremy. He says, Mr. Lemkuhl had me burned at the stake as a witch. That's a lesson I won't forget anytime soon. And I actually, we don't have time to have an interview today with Mr. Lemkuhl, although I spoke with him. And one of the things he said was, you know, juniors and seniors in high school aren't very interested in history, and they're not thinking very much about the future. They are mostly interested in the here and now. So that does create a real challenge to get them excited about and engaged in history. And Dominic Iannone is still here. He's a social studies teacher at West High in Iowa City. So, Dominic, how do you do that when you know that you've got a bunch of students who are really, really concerned about lunchtime and Friday night and text messages and what's going on in their world right now? How do you engage them in history?
Well, see, that's a great question for me to ramble about, but I promised my wife I wouldn't ramble. So I think that all of us recognize that there's a lot of competitors for students' attention nowadays and that media plays a big role in that. So I think that there's been sort of an emphasis on this idea of trying to make education more entertaining, which I'm not opposed to, except for I don't like that word entertaining. I prefer engaging, because I think that calling it entertaining makes it sound like it should be fun and that we almost need to trick students into not recognizing that they're doing work, when actually sometimes hard work is how you get the most meaningful understandings. So I think the key is to find ways to make things relevant and engaging, but in ways that require the sustained attention rather than just lots of transitions and lots of videos and things like that are good for getting kids to look at something but not necessarily really pay attention to it. So, for example, last week in my European history class, we were looking at existentialism, which is kind of a heavy topic for 14 and 15-year-olds to look at. And rather than doing something like creating a comic strip, we actually sat, and over the course of 2 days, we split it up. They spent about 40 minutes in small groups engaging with a document about existentialism and talking about it in small groups and then discussing it as a class, kind of like a Socratic seminar. And that might not sound like the most fun that you could have in a class, but I think that a lot of kids walked away more engaged with it, and I heard conversations in the hall after the class was over, which is always a good sign that shows the kids are actually thinking about it.
Absolutely.
So I try and get my kids to embrace the complexity of issues, and I think then they find them more meaningful.
Well, and as Tom was saying just a few minutes ago, that he didn't like to focus so much on the names and the dates. But how do you measure whether students are understanding what you're talking about and retaining it?
Yeah, assessment is tricky in social studies. It is easy to test for names and dates, and I think that knowing names and dates do have their value. I don't like to undercut that, because I think that to be a well-educated person and to engage meaningfully in complex discussions, you have to have a body of knowledge that you can draw from. But at the same time, one of my favorite ways of assessing is through writing. Because rather than using multiple choice to kind of find things that students don't know, written assignments give kids a chance to talk about the things that they do know. That those are challenging because it requires a lot of scaffolding, because you have to teach an entire skill, which is writing, before you can actually assess their knowledge. So there's actually two pieces of assessment there, the skill and the content. But I think that's – in social studies, when we want people to critically engage with something, we think discussion – discussions are hard to assess. Writing gives us something a little bit more concrete. So I do a lot of writing assignments.
And you focus a lot of your work now with exceptional students, with advanced students. Does that give you more freedom?
In some ways it does, although they certainly hold you accountable. You know, the challenge with high-performing students is that you have to always be extremely well-prepared, because they will ask you questions about everything. And so you have to be ready for that. Which means that you have to be a little bit more ahead of them. But it does mean that you can – some of those sort of sustained activities that I was talking about, because of the motivation level, it can be a little bit easier to do those kinds of things.
And you also teach a summer course with gifted students at the Bell and Blank Center. What do you do with that?
Yeah, so I teach in eighth grade. It's a week-long residential class where eighth grade students from all over the country come in, and they actually stay in the dorms at University of Iowa for a week. And I get them for 6 hours a day, which sounds like a really long time for junior high kids. But by breaking it up into chunks, and it's basically a survey of the social sciences. So we have a day, for example, where we go to the Hoover Library, and students get to actually go into the back, and they get their official researcher card, which they love, and they get to look at actual, not copies of, but actual historical documents, and they really like that.
So what do you think, from observing your students, can you give me an example? I mean, you mentioned talking about existentialism, but can you give me an example of another time when you have seen all the lights go on, and the students suddenly think, wait a minute, I care about this, and it actually relates to my life somehow?
Sure. I think one of the things that helps do that is by building in as much choice as possible. Sometimes the challenge is to make students think that they have more freedom over their choices than they really do, because you want to guide them to meaningful things. But when you give them, for example, a research project, but not necessarily a research topic, you kind of – so we did a unit on resistance during World War II, and I threw a lot of names and people out there that they had no idea who any of these people were, with just the general theme of how do individuals make a difference in the grand scope of history. And different kids got to basically choose who they wanted to, and so they get to kind of guide their own discovery, and then they came back and presented to the class. And I found that a lot of kids – were really engaged with that, and they got really into their research and drew connections to things that we had learned in the classroom. So I think that giving students choice helps a lot.
And in a moment, we're going to talk more about opportunities that teachers have to further their own education and engage students in different new ways. Do you feel like you have enough resources as a teacher?
In some ways, yeah. It kind of depends on the course. It's kind of interesting because there are certain courses where there's more material available. But the other problem is sometimes not so much that there's not material, it's that there's so much material and resources available that it's hard to find the time to sift through it and find the pieces that are really useful in the classroom in the midst of all the other things you have to do during the day.
Do you get a chance to connect with other teachers and pick their brains?
Yeah, we do. We have preps, open periods built into the day, but that's we have certain meeting times where we get together that are planned, and then the rest of it's kind of on our own.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about teaching social studies in Iowa. And during the next part of the show, we're going to focus on some really innovative opportunities for educators to really help bring history to life for their students. I was just talking with Dominic Iannone. He's a social studies teacher at West High in Iowa City. And you're welcome to join this conversation as well. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and this hour we're talking about teaching social studies in Iowa schools. And I have with me a room full of educators and very educated individuals. I've been talking with Dominic Iannone, who is a social studies teacher at West High School. Also joining us now is Elizabeth Dinchel. She is education specialist at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hello. How
are you? Very good. Circe Stumbo is still with us. She's president of West Wind Education Policy in Iowa City. And also here now is Henry Harper. He is former director of Fast Track, and he for many years, 7 years, in fact, led civil rights tours. And Henry, tell me a little bit about what you did. You actually went on tours with at-risk students?
Yes, we took like 52, average of 52 students every year during spring break through the civil rights movement through Memphis down to Atlanta. We visited like six cities and nine HBCUs during this time to help these students understand how history is important and how education fit into their future plans, which has been very successful over the last 7 years.
All right. So going on a tour, you went to places that were very significant in the civil rights movement.
Yeah. So like I said, we started in Memphis at the Lorraine Hotel. Then we went to Birmingham. And then we went during this process, we found a slave plantation called Gee's Bend, where they made quilts that told runaway slaves where to go when they run underground. And which we found them, we go to Selma, Alabama, where they have freedom of voters march, and we were all down to Montgomery. Then we went down to Atlanta, ended in Atlanta. So that we did it for the last 7 years over spring break.
Wow. And when you were on these tours, were you the educator when you reached these sites, or did you have people who had experience in the civil rights movement that could talk to the students? How did you bring this history to life other than being in the place?
Well, as we progressed over the years, we had individuals at each site. Like in Selma, we had an individual that actually part of the Voters' Right March that day come in, give them the whole Selma tour and talk about what happened here, what was going on the bridge, and explain the whole process to them. We did the same thing with Rosa Park Museum in Montgomery. We had individuals that actually was part of these movements. And during this process, we do like five or six HBCU schools, which Alabama State is one of the most important parts of the civil rights movement. Students were actually led to march in Montgomery and Birmingham. So we have students from those that still teach there or either part of the community that come in and walk them through the whole process of how the movement got started in Montgomery and how they was part of the walk from Selma to Montgomery. So they got a pretty intense understanding of the movement and why the movement was important to all of us and also as a black students to take advantage of education and stop making excuses and blame, because there's a lot of people that's involved in this process. So living in Iowa is an opportunity to get education and be part of that of their own outcome. So just breaking that whole thing down for these students, got them to understand that living in Iowa is a very great place to get education. And we tried to simplify that process by saying, hey, you are where you need to be, so take an opportunity while you're here to take responsibility for your own education.
Well, and Circe, I know that you actually got to go along on one of these trips.
I did, yes.
So what was it like to see the students visit these places and hear these stories?
You know, these students, one of the things that I got to do was work with them to write a blog about their experience. And so they would reflect after the day. And it was just amazing the powerful thinking that was going on. They discovered that the history of the civil rights movement was long but also recent, that it's current as well as past. And as Mr. Harper just indicated, that youth were very much a part of the civil rights movement. I think that was one of the most empowering days, was in Birmingham, to learn about the role of the youth in the march and then to meet with the current mayor, who was quite honestly excited about having those students there that day as part of the ongoing work toward social justice.
Well, and I have goosebumps just thinking about this, Henry, but this went on for 7 years. So there are students now who went on these trips with you who have been through college. Do you hear from kids?
Yes. Well, actually, I just went to graduation last week, you and I.
Nice.
A young lady that actually was original, or one of the person that started this program, she want to start a program herself in Marshalltown. And so she's pretty excited about what she's learned during this process. And when I talk to these students, and what has really changed their lives is the fact that when they went on this trip, the fact that, you know, they understand that, you know, living in Iowa, having teachers that actually support them, but also understanding their responsibility to get an education. And there are a lot of people that fought for the right for them to have an opportunity to get education. It was really powerful for a lot of these students to understand that there's no blame here. You know, and there's a lot of people, even their teachers here in Iowa, that want to see them successful, and they are responsible for taking hold of that and running with it. So this trip has been huge. It's changed lives of a lot of kids. And also we have taken parents, and we've taken community members, professors, and so having the community as a whole support these kids, along with the going through the civil rights and visiting the black colleges, has been change kids' academic process and right. Also change kids' outcomes about getting a good education in one of the better places in this country to get to do that in the Iowa City School District.
And I understand that the future of this program is in jeopardy. Is that?
Well, yes, it is. Yes, it is. And that's one of the things that we try to teach these kids, to take responsibility for their own education and not ask for things, but also put the work in and earn everything that they get. And we have taught them to understand that they're willing to do that. There are many people willing to support them to do the right thing, but they have to do the right thing. So, you know, again, you know, this one thing has changed their outlook about their own education and the fact that, hey, I am responsible for my own education. As a program, we try to simplify what we want from them, because we want them to understand that education is the foundation of your future. And again, there are people that actually have fought and died for this opportunity for you, so you need to take advantage of that. And a lot of kids have taken that and ran with it, you know, and we try to break it down to them to understand and say, you can't blame anyone if you don't go to school and get an opportunity and talk to your teachers and advocate for your own change.
Well, Henry, thank you so much for telling us about this. And, you know, not every teacher can take their children to these historical sites, but there are a lot of things that teachers can do to bring history alive. And I know Elizabeth Dinchel of the Hoover Museum, you do a lot to help teachers figure out the ways that they can do that. And you run development programs for teachers during the summer?
I do. We have two coming up this summer. One of them related to Henry's topic as well. Our first one is going to be July 10th and 11th. It's with Annette Dunlap. She is a First Lady's biographer. She wrote a biography of Frances Cleveland, and she's working on one with Lou Henry Hoover. And we're doing it in conjunction with the First Lady's exhibit that we have in the museum, so that teachers can kind of fill the gaps between teaching material culture with artifacts. And so we talk about engaging students with artifacts and with primary sources to get them interested, to make it relevant, like we had spoken about. One of the other things we end up working on is how to assess that, how the students interact with the artifacts and the primary sources. And we're using Stanford's Beyond the Bubble model to build the assessments for their lesson plans. Our second one is called Witness to History, Using Photographs and Oral Histories to Teach History. And that one, teachers can get either license renewal credit or continuing education credit through Drake University for. And we're bringing artifacts in from the National Archives. The Hoover is a National Archives facility. And we're bringing in some guest speakers. We're bringing Matt Herron. He was a civil rights photographer. He photographed the Selma March. He also worked in Macomb, Mississippi, and he worked for SNCC. But he's a very interesting case study because sometimes in the classroom we just look at photographs with students and we miss the story behind the photographer who was part of it. And he wasn't necessarily involved with the activism, but he was a witness to it. And after this started to unfurl, he found himself becoming an activist because he felt so impassioned about something that started off as a professional assignment. And so we're going to use him kind of as a case study to talk about that. And his oral history. So the teachers will get to hear from him one-on-one, and then they'll get to go back with their students and have their oral history that was recorded with Matt and his photographs to teach something like the Selma March in school. We're also bringing Elizabeth Partridge in from San Francisco, and she's the goddaughter of Dorothea Lange, and she'll be talking about Dorothea's photographs and how they fit into the context of the Great Depression, and it's alleged that a lot of her photos were staged. So she's going to address that and talk to the students about why it's a possibility and why people might assume her photographs were staged. So we can kind of look at that critical thinking behind the visual literacy aspect of it. And we'll be using Docs Teach and Beyond the Bubble for that. And that one's in August. That one will run August 6th through the 8th. It'll be 3 days. And the African American Museum in Cedar Rapids will be coming to talk after Matt Herron about the civil rights movement in Iowa. So teachers can kind of provide a local connection to the civil rights movement. So students don't think it's just something that happened in Selma.
And how do teachers get involved with this? I mean, who can attend?
All teachers can attend, and they can register through the Grant Wood AEA. And if they want to attend for non-credit, they can also call me directly, and I'll get them a seat reserved for, as well.
So why is this so important to you to make sure that, teachers get to come in and see these primary sources and get a firsthand look at the historical artifacts that you can bring to Iowa?
Well, you know, and we do programs with our high school students that connect them right with the primary sources. But what we want the teachers to see is that when they put the primary sources in the students' hands, they get to understand that there's a whole process behind the construction of how we interpret history. It's not just what we read in our textbook. It's not just what we see on the latest documentary. It's all these little pieces that come together to tell the entire story. And for them to make that connection, that personal connection, to hold a telegraph in their hand, they're very excited by that. And you can see them digging further and further because they want to know more. They've never experienced history. This is an experience. The tour is an experience. Using historic places as a primary source is an experience. That's what we have to give our students. They're adaptive learners now. They need that connection, that sensory experience to make them interested in what we're working on.
Now, of course, you have all of these resources with the Hoover Museum, and so people in this part of the state of Iowa, in the eastern part of the state of Iowa, have great access. There's, of course, the State Historical Museum in Des Moines, but also there are so many little museums in all of our communities all over Iowa. Do you think that there is a lot of potential for access to primary sources that isn't being explored?
Well, of course. And I think most of those places are very open to having field trips with students and exposing them to primary sources. They're just as excited as all of us sitting in this room. They just might not have the same kind of pull that we have. And we see students taking that initiative to get to the local places, through programs like National History Day. They know if they engage locally, they're more likely to have access to primary sources and more likely to go to national competition.
And History Day, I was a competitor in History Day, so I know about it, but not everybody does. So explain what it is, please.
I always equate it to like the science fair for history at school. It's a wonderful program, and we make students engage with the process of writing history, and they can do performance, documentary, exhibits, or papers. They have to use primary sources. They have to use secondary sources. They have to be able to identify what those are. They have to write a thesis statement. They have to put their historic event into historic context. They have to say how history was different after this event took place. They have to get grilled by judges at regionals, districts, state. And after they go to state, they have the opportunity to go to nationals in Washington, D.C. And Iowa students have been heavy hitters at National History Day. It's a wonderful program for students to feel like they get to write history. They're not just being talked at for a class period. They're not just writing a paper because they have to. They get to find something that interests them, and they get to turn it into a project that they're excited about. And they have to understand the process.
You know, Dominic, we got an email. You were talking about your conversation about existentialism in your class. And this is from Sue, who says, Mr. Iannone's approach to existentialism was very successful. My daughter's in his class at West I, and she and I had a very lively discussion about existentialism over dinner. After she learned about it in his class, I was impressed with how much she knew about the subject. But I'm curious, you know, in that case, you got to have this discussion in the classroom. Did the students get up out of their seats, or were they...
Yeah, I try. I mean, physical movement is good for teenagers.
Well, I'm curious about, you know...
Sometimes it's as simple as just... change it, like when you have transitions from one group to another, giving them the chance to get up and move around the room and talk to different people and just get a slight change of venue can help keep them going, especially around lunchtime.
Well, and you know, Elizabeth, you were talking about performance, and I'm sure that actually physically engaging with a historical subject helps. I mean, I'm sure that once a child does a History Day performance, they never forget it. But I'm wondering, Dominic, in your class, do you find that if you get the kids to physically engage with the subject, does that change their understanding?
Yeah, and it's a good way to get them to participate too. I just the other day did this sort of like classic lesson that you'll see in a lot of rooms where you kind of have a strongly disagree corner, strongly agree, and you kind of have them take stances. And so everybody has to get up and move to a corner. But once they've chosen a corner, then you feel justified in calling on them and asking them why they chose that corner. And then they get a chance to move around again. And so, yeah, it can help a lot. But, I hear all this and I just think about the importance of stories. And I think that kids – everybody likes stories. And so the nice thing about primary sources and getting them engaged with those is that it gives them the opportunity to see the real people behind the stories instead of kind of simplifying it into a heroes and villains kind of version of history. Seeing that these are real people struggling with real concepts, I think, is good for them.
Now, whenever I see a poll done or even, you know, silly things done on late night television where people are asked simple questions right. about what they know about their government, I despair, like everyone does, about, you know, what our general knowledge is about our government and about how it works. From your perspective in the classroom, how does the future look? Do you think that kids are engaging with civics and with history? Are we making progress?
I think kids are engaged, and I think that some of that is a little bit misleading. We've talked about those shows before. My classes actually, they get that selection bias. If somebody gets it right, they're not going to put that on TV because that's not entertaining.
Right.
I think that young kids do struggle to engage with social issues because they don't see the relevancy to their daily lives yet. But that's one of the challenges of being a good social studies teacher, is trying to draw the connections to their lives so they can see that relevancy.
Well, and we were talking earlier about with the kind of freedom that schools have, whether or not social studies is falling by the wayside. Circe, you didn't feel that it is. Elizabeth, I think you have a little bit different take. But...
Well, a little bit. One of the things that we're trying to pioneer is new assessment methods so that students know why things are important and not just what they are, not what year the Declaration of Independence was signed, but why we signed it and why we benefit from it now, and building those assessment tools so that we know students are learning to think critically.
And we're out of time, but thank you all so much for coming today. Elizabeth Dinchel, Education Specialist at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. Henry Harper, thank you, former Director of Fast Track and leader of the Civil Rights Tours. Circe Stumbo, President of West Wind. I'm sorry. I lost that piece of paper. All right. Circe Sumbo, president of West Wind Education Policy in Iowa City, and Dominic Iannone, social studies teacher at West High in Iowa City. This is Talk of Iowa.